Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did you ever see a colt like that? Look at all the gay coats these old cats are wearing. If we ever put a pimp in this outfit, we couldn't find it. You sounded like you were dedicating a warped cornerstone. My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. That sounds good. That's the salutation that saved my life. Believe it. Somebody said, "Hi, Joe, we're glad you're here." And that's the very salutation that saved my life. Looking at this crowd, it's a fabulous thing, isn't it? This has been a wonderful convention. I can't help, I'd love to quote one of the greatest philosophers of all time, a fellow by the name of Dizzy Dean, who one day was broadcasting a baseball game and sitting there sipping on that beer, and which was his wont. And he looked out and very quietly said, "You know, it just occurred to me how much room there is out in left field. And as I look at this bunch out here, I believe he's right about that, you know. Because we're all here because we're not all there." Now, I don't know how to get started here, because this has been such a great occurrence. Really, it has. I will say that I don't see how anybody could come and sit in a group like this and see the manifestation of God's handiwork for we desperate people and not go away believing in something. I see that impossibility. But everybody's talked about everything. I come from the smart part of Texas. She's over there, that girl that's from Spang, Texas. That's a big town. You ought to see it. They've got one yellow page in the telephone book. But really, I'm down in our country. I heard this gentleman here give his sobriety day. Down in our country, we do that too. We feel that if you don't give it, you might not have one. So I've been sober and in this facility actively for 2 months and 26 years. And I would love to talk a little while tonight, maybe to some of the newcomers, and tell you what you might expect in this society of ours, the things you may hear, and some of the things that you can look forward to. And the book that we have called Alcoholics Anonymous, some of the promises therein that can be fulfilled. As far as your restoration of dignity and the loss of all the humiliations and the indignities that you heaped upon yourself. And I heard the fellow talk this afternoon. God, what a beautiful story, recovery. And he made a statement that he expected these people to ask him all about himself. And I would say to you newcomers that you're not accountable for anything that happened the other side of that door. And that's all. Would you satisfy a whim and an old man, just for the pure hell of it, would everybody here, that if you're not too anonymous, who's less than 6 months sober or making your first convention, could I see your hand just for fun? You people ain't been idle down here. You must be doing something right. But let's talk a little about it. I'm an old AA member, and I have formed a few opinions down through the years. There's not a great deal to look forward to being an old AA member, really. In the animal world, when the animals panic, they eat their young. In AA, when they panic, they eat their old. And the popularity of being in AA is a very fleeting thing. It doesn't last forever. I'll give you a good example of it. When I came to AA, I was a real go boy, and I picked up the cups and washed them, and they even allowed me to paint our AA club. And one of the older members came up to me and he said, "Feller, you've got a good attitude. I can tell that you're going to make this program." 25 years later, I picked up the same dirty cups and started to wash them, and a new man was heard to say, "Look at the old bastard, he's still trying to run it." I think that, really, I don't know where to start. Maybe I can tell a story about a psychiatrist that was wandering through the grounds of one of our, they call them hospitals now, don't they? Used to be nut houses when I went to them. And he was walking through the grounds of this institution, and he came upon one of the inmates, I believe. They call them patients. Hell, we've come up in the world now, you know. And this fellow was laying bricks in this hospital yard and doing a beautiful job of it. It was really a thing to see. It was actually a feat of symmetrical beauty. And this psychiatrist was visibly impressed at the dexterity with which this nut was laying the brick. And he said to Mr. Nut, "Are you crazy?" And he said, "Well, certainly not. My people resent me, and they've had me committed to this place." And the psychiatrist was even more impressed, and he said, "How would you like to get out of here and get back into society?" He said, "A man that is as efficient as you are needs to be back out in the world. Would you like that?" And he said, "Yes, sir, I would." He said, "Next Thursday, I'm sitting on the board here, and we're having a meeting, and I'm going to intercede in your behalf. And we're going to try to get you out of this hospital." And he turned to walk away, and the nut picked up a brick and hit him in the back of the head. And he went to his knees, and he finally shook himself and finally staggered back to his feet, and he turned to the nut and said, "What'd you do that for?" And he said, "I just didn't want you to forget Thursday." A lot of us have come to this society by way of those places, you know, the places, these joints and so forth. And it's not a bad thing to be, because we're all a little bit, we've even got a step in our program that takes care of people like me who have a gopher in the garden, so to speak, and it's all well fixed. But being an old member in AA, I'll say to you new ones that you'll hear lots of things in AA that'll sound strange to you. When you come to the meetings, every meeting they'll talk about humility. And you'll hear them talk a whole lot about humility. You may never live long enough to see any. But they'll talk about it at great length. And then the last vestige of giving up, the old drunk, he comes to AA and he wants to hold on to some sort of a symbol of being a human being. And when he gets up behind one of these podiums, he says, "But I came from a fine Christian family. I'm beginning to believe that fine Christian families are breeding places for alcoholism." And then you hear a lot of new language that we didn't hear years ago when I came to AA about this illness. Some of the new nomenclature. Somebody brought it up here, I believe the girl from down in Idiotville down there. A term that I never heard when I came to AA, detoxify. We used to puke a great deal, but them fellas are about 41 years late with that. Did you know that if you took the human body and laid it down and didn't put any alcohol in it, it'll detoxify itself? I used to do it every time I got out of jail. There's nothing to it, really. Then you hear some of the experts talk about the whole in-depth study. Hypoallergenic. Then the psychiatrist, he uses a term that I'd never heard before. He says you have an alcoholic syndrome. I used to think that a syndrome was a cat house where they competed. You got alcoholic syndrome. I thought, how lucky can you get? You know. then they talk about a thing that's real good. They talk about establishing a behavior pattern. Did you ever have a behavior pattern? The only thing about an alcoholic that is consistent is his inconsistency. If Mr. Drunk walks by your house every day at 3:30 sharp for 18 and a half years, and one day you say to yourself, "I'll go out and chat with him today," the bastard won't come by. We're a strange lot. Really, we are. And we are subjected to all of this. None of it, I believe, has a great deal to do with our staying sober or getting drunk. Really. I have come to see that. And right now, in our society, with some of the things that we see and hear, I'm beginning to believe that bad information is killing more drunks than alcohol is. All you got to do is to read some of that jazz that we hear in there about alcoholism and its cure. I appeared on a radio show up in Canada the other day, and the interrogator, is that what you call him? whatever the hell he was, he had long hair. When he got through, he just beamed, and he said, "You've been a nice participant in this radio show. We've done a great deal of good. I'm going to give you a present." He gave me a book by Dr. Milton Finkelstein, Reading Alcoholism and Its Cure. And I thanked him profusely and said to him, "I want to read that just as quick as I'm through with the book I'm now reading." And I didn't tell him the book I'm now reading is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do not propose to be through with it very soon. But alcoholism, Whitney said it last night, it's up in the world, popular, it's a great thing. You see it every time you turn around, it's vogue. We're even on soap operas now, do you know that? I just came back from Hollywood, and we've replaced two homosexuals and one bad over it. And I go in the afternoon, my wife's laying up eating chocolates listening to that crap, you know? My son's an alcoholic, you know. Dear John, he may not come home today. And all that jazz. We're up in the world and it's popular. We used to be worried about the stigma on alcoholism. It used to be a bad thing, you know. And now, our biggest problem is keeping out the social climbers in that area. There are people who are coming to AA because they think it's the thing to do. I didn't come that way. It was a last gasp affair with me. And I didn't hunt for you either. Bunch of cake-eating, coffee-drinking, uninteresting, drab bastards like this, I wouldn't have touched you with a 10-foot pole. You were not sophisticated enough for the genius, I'll tell you. And I like to die because of it. I have never seen anybody too dumb to make this program. But I've been a pallbearer for some awful smart ones. This is no place for the erudite and the learned. Our Bill wouldn't have put it in that fifth chapter that the boy read a while ago. We tried to hold on to our old ideas. And you know what the result was? Nothing. So I think that our Society of Alcoholics Anonymous may be a process of unlearning some things. Discarding some of the bad information and the old wives' tales that we've lived with for so long. Some of the things that we've had to listen to and the old cliches that a misunderstanding society has beat us to earth with. Oh, lots of them. Straighten out, be a man. You ain't ever heard that, have you? I did, just like that. Straightened right out on the floor. "Haven't you learned your lesson this time?" they said to me. Or here was a good one. "Why don't you turn over a new leaf?" I'd love to say here that the only guy I ever heard of that had any luck turning over them leaves was that Adam chap we read about in the Bible. And the dog stays away from us in droves. He thinks he's got to qualify to be an alcoholic. Years ago, when I came there, they had some little innocuous questions.
what were they, 44, I believe?
44 questions, was it, John?
Yeah, 44. Little old, weak, little innocuous questions like, did your boss give you that look today? I got some questions here that may fit you into our society. Did you ever have the roof of your mouth sunburned? Have you ever had malfunction of the zipper? They used to call me Rusty. Have you ever been arrested while in jail? Have you ever been run over by your own car while driving it? Have you ever woke up in the morning feeling rather delicately and lose your glasses and wash your teeth with preparation H? That'll make you say it. Good morning, dear. You know, from the recognition, I suspect that we have some folks here that are qualified for this society tonight. So I'm going to talk to you on that level. Then maybe you're ready. I don't know. Maybe you're ready to be with us. Then you see a lot of things. You come into AA and you see a lot of cliches, and there's a lot of symbols and butterflies. And then praying hands. What if the fellow that had drawn that picture of those praying hands had been a baby strangler, and he'd called them the strangling hands? You wouldn't like them near as well. That's auto-suggestion. And it proves that if a drunk says something 3 days in a row and nobody argues with him, it becomes a law. Really, you know that. We got a lot of stuff floating around AA today that are absolutely no part of it. And I hope that we never become a trinket-worshipping, cliché-popping, mutual admiration society. This is not what we're here for. The object of Alcoholics Anonymous is not sainthood. It's sobriety. That's what we're here for. I didn't come to be a saint. I'm writing a book now about it, but the title of my book will be In Pursuit of Sainthood or Sex on Social Security. But this is, I've been in the publishing business for 25 years now, still in it a little bit, and it has become my contention that when a feller blows his noggin and just loses it altogether, he'll do one of two things. he'll either catch a bus or write a book. And I'm a block from the bus station down there. And I get these nuts, and I spend more of my time trying to talk people out of printing books than I do printing them, really. But this is another symptom of our illness. So, for God's sake, don't write a book. We've got one that folks won't read much. It's under title Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says on the front page that it's the basic text for our society. And we're the luckiest bunch of folks on earth because we got a manual to go by. Most anybody else that's got an illness, they can't get a lot of information about it. They can't find a way to solve their problems or live in the solution, but we're lucky. We've got a book that on the second page of it says how many thousands of men and women have recovered. That book, I hope, is going to catch on one of these days in AA, and we can use it to its fullest extent because the fellow that wrote it put six purposes in it instead of one. And I've heard him say it out of his own mouth so many times that we wrote the book to keep the message from becoming garbled. And after he became engrossed in these 11 chapters that talk about us, he put about a half a dozen more purposes in there. In the second chapter, he says the purpose of this book is to comfort and inform those who are affected. In chapter 4, he says to find a power greater than yourself. Well, that is what this book is all about. And in every chapter of this thing, you can find the purpose for it. And he mentions this book, or these pages, 17 times in the course of its writing. And I would say to you new members, if your sponsor has not put a book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in your hands by this time, you may not need a book. You need a new sponsor. Because I firmly believe, and I hope I don't hurt anybody's feelings, that there are three reasons why everybody in AA ought to have books. One, that if you should accidentally get well in our society and want to stay that way, you'll know how it happened. Two, that if you're conversant with the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you have an independence of sobriety and you do not have to be dependent upon weak, fallible people like me. Number three is a rather humorous reason. They're awful good to check your sponsor out with. And if your sponsor prefaces anything that he's got to say to you with, all you got to do is hunt your sponsor. Until you can find one that says all you got to do is do it all. Believe me. And this is the greatest treatise upon any illness that's ever been written by mankind. And in the second sentence in the foreword of the old book, he makes a boast there that could be a trip in egomania. But I think it sprang from love. We hope, he said, that these pages will be so convincing that no further authentication is necessary. Hey, that would indicate that that book's enough, wouldn't it? We're the only people in the alcoholism field who have a track record that's not made up of gobbledygook statistics. Because tonight I stand here and look at the most beautiful track record that one could ever see. Every time we go to an AA meeting, we're looking at the track record and don't forget it. And I'm tired of hearing people apologize for being an AA. This, my friends, is the most prideful thing you will ever be engaged in, believe me. Because you're looking at a man that was a total nothing, an absolute failure in all departments, until I found that society called Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me say that for the record. Now I'll tell you a little about my drinking. We have one thing in Alcoholics Anonymous that we all agree on. This is the only thing that AA members will agree about. The rest of the things they fight over. Alcoholics drink. Don't they? I did. Started rather innocently. Came from a fine Christian family. I came from a fine one of them East Texas Methodist families, and I have three uncles. Had three. They passed on to their reward, whatever that may be. That were Methodist preachers, and I was destined to be a Methodist preacher. And I was raised in the Methodist church. And in spite of that, I still believe in God. But I drank real early at the age of 17, and for no good reason except to be accepted as one of the boys. And I think so many of us do that. Came by it innocently. Probably that's the last thing that we ever did, innocently, was to take our first drink. But I did it to be accepted. And I remember it vividly. I remember that night. I remember taking that first drink of alcohol. I remembered what it did. Now, you know, somebody, some wag, wrote a story here recently about making an investigation between alcoholics and non-alcoholics. And he said that all the alcoholics that he had interviewed, and I go along with him on this, remembered their first drink. He said that non-alcoholics don't remember it. But all the alcoholics that he had interviewed remembered taking their first drink. I wonder why. Because it meant something to me. It really meant something to me, that first drink. That night, things changed. And I thought to myself many things, but where on God's earth have I been for this? And I never, as long as I drank, forgot the great exhilaration, the freedom that that drink gave me that night. It wasn't compulsive. Wasn't sickness, wasn't an illness, but it left something hanging up here in this fungus between my ears that let me know that if I needed to feel better, I had the answer. And I began to do a thing that we lightly talk about, begin to use alcohol. That's what we did, use alcohol. And I did, really. So I got ready to go to a party. I was a timid guy. Oh, gosh, yes, just the most timid. They call me a precocious youngster. And I could get a belt full of that flit, and I was the life of the party. Life of the party. It did all of the necessary things that I was not equipped with. And I went back to it again and again and again. I don't know when it became compulsive. I left Tyler. The town suddenly grew too small for me, gentleman of my accomplishments. And I went to a place called Hollywood, California, if any of you have ever heard of that freakdom. And to pick a profession, I chose the weirdest thing that you could ever think of. I became an understudy to one of the famous designers of ladies' lingerie. Now, this is an East Texas country boy who had just come out of the sticks, and to have this sort of life foisted off on him, it's quite an experience. And this loving Jewish fellow took me in, and he spent a lot of money on my education. And he liked me. And he said one day, if you stay with me, you'll go far. And I ultimately did. And became rather a skilled man in the profession, acquired a name even. You're looking at the man that started or helped start this slack thing in the year 1937. The firm that I worked for put the first pair of slacks on Marlena Dietrich. And from that time on, you know where it's gone to. I see a few out here tonight. This is the profession where you cut these soft, silk, sleazy, intimate things that the women wear. It's a very pleasurable occupation. And we have that step in AA to which I alluded a while ago. The second step in our program where it infers that you may have that gopher up in the garden. Now, if you cut a bunch of brassieres with three of those places in them, you're nuts. There's no question about it. And I told a psychiatrist about that later, and he said that was just wishful thinking. And damn if I don't believe he was right. Needless to say, I cut myself out of that profession, literally. So, just ruined my whole reputation. And this fellow came to me and told me something one day that most of you have heard, I guess. If you haven't heard it and you keep sucking on that flip bottle, you'll hear it. He said, "Joe, you can't drink. Can't. Can't. This is a word that the alcoholic cannot stand. Can't. Don't." Well, this drives us mad. We cannot stand that sort of a thing. You can't drink. Don't do that. Don't do that. I was making a talk the other day in one of our finer universities down in the lunchroom, and I had to stand there and look at a sign over on the wall that said, "Don't take the dishes out of this room." I've got two plates in my den at home. I can't stand don't. It's not in the alcoholic nature to don't. He said you can't drink. And then he added some words that I guess every drunk's ever heard. You gotta go. You gotta go. This was the first loss of the first great opportunity that I had ever had. Kind of gutted me a little bit. I know that every alcoholic has had that. I would love to say to you that very recently I have retired from my fifth profession. And I went into every one of them a fraud. But a drunk knows how to take this, and this is the beginning of the route, the route of humiliation and indignity, the path of hurt, the path of feeling bad, the path of trying to justify our position. But once obsessed the drink, there's no further justification. And this fine fellow said to me, "You got to go." And he was a Jewish fellow and a rather humorous wag. And he said to me, "You know, something good comes out of everything. The way you handle those scissors, if you'd have been a rabbi, you would have destroyed our whole race." And you gotta let that roll around for a little while, haven't you? And I went. First job. Oh, the hurt that an alcoholic has. You know, our book talks in so many places about the alcoholic being completely defenseless. Defenseless. This occurs in our book many times. And this is the beginning of a defenseless route of alcoholism. Oh, I went down to the shipyard in San Pedro
And somebody was up here. Who was it? The boy this afternoon was a plumber. I went to the shipyard. I went down in the Union Hall and bought a plumber's license out the back door of this Union Hall. And I went into the shipyard as a master plumber. Now, here's a fellow that had never picked up anything any heavier than a pair of scissors before. And I went in there as a master plumber. You can well imagine I was a master fraud. Those were the days when you were frozen to your job. God forbid that. Here you go again. You can't quit. There we are. You can't. Don't. Well, I was frozen to my job. But it didn't take me long to thaw out. I have a piece of a document that hangs in my den presently that's signed by the United States Department of War Labor, and it prohibits me from working within 25 miles of the city of Los Angeles. You can't. Don't. I'll show. And I wandered up into Northern California, and the progression of our illness, haven't you found that it kind of goes like this? You know, they say, how's Joe's drinking? Oh, it's a little better now. Yeah, I guess it is. He's hitting his old hole more and his old bladder stretched, but I've never seen anybody who was obsessed to drink whose drinking improved. How you doing, Joe? Great. Fine. But the things that I could get to do were becoming less good, if that's a good description. And I went up into Northern California, and they must have needed help real bad. And I went to work for the railroad. And I'd love to say here that those are the most narrow-minded people I have ever met. They have a rule about drinking. They have it reads that if you're seen coming out of an establishment that dispenses alcoholic beverages, you can be fired. I never came out very often. And I suppose they were well justified in this assumption. They run more than one train on a single track. And I never did. I still don't know how they did it, really. It just boggled my mind. I used to lay abed at night and worry about running more than one train on the track. And I'd get out there and be frightened to death. And I knew that one day it had happened to me. I just knew that it was in the books. I just couldn't ever fathom how you could run two trains on one track. Now, the railroad made the mistake. They had the unmitigated gall to hang a bulletin up in their depot in Sacramento, and it read in there about a certain piece of track that we used up on top of the Sierra Nevada mountains where we cut the helpers off of the engine. And it was a big electronic system, and the railroad company put this in that bulletin. It is physically impossible to make a mistake up there. Here we go again. They said to me, you can't make a mistake up there. That's the way I read it. Physically impossible. This thing was so electronically perfect, it was made by the Sperry Company. This series of signals that worked so synchromatically alert, if you lose the word, you can't make a mistake. By some quirk of circumstance and hard work and a little alcoholic research, I got two engines going towards one another with four cars between them, carrots, apples, lettuce, and celery, and I made the biggest damn fruit salad that has ever been made
in the history of mankind. And these narrow-minded people wanted to fire me about it. They were upset. Hadn't ruined, but over $45,000 worth of equipment. What much? And they have in railroads, they're kind of like the government, about 20% efficient sometimes. And they have investigations. And I had an alcoholic representing me at this investigation, and we proved a thing that was about a million to one shot of happening. Stood there with both of our faces hanging out and proved it beyond a shadow of a doubt that there had been a Mexican track walker walking along at this particular time with a lantern in his hand, and I had mistaken his lantern for a given signal. Now, they never found that Mexican. And they gave me 60 days. And I remember the old superintendent came out of this investigation and he was livid with rage. And he said to me, "I'll get you if it's the last thing I ever do." And I would love to repeat what the fellow said here this afternoon about getting even. You don't have to get even with a drunk. Don't waste your time. You do not have to get even with a poor, sick alcoholic. He's got a mechanism built within himself that'll take care of him. He'll get even with himself if you leave him to his own devices. So if you're going to do anything, just don't try to get even with a drunk. He's got that pop-off valve right down here. And one day it'll go off. Don't get even, you Al-Anon, with a drunk. There's no torture that you can devise. There are no words that you can use that he hasn't already used upon himself early in the morning. While he's laying these sick hours being ashamed of himself for something that he had no control over whatsoever, that were projections of an obsession that he couldn't control. And I got down. And I got on. I love to use this expression. I'm sure John would appreciate this. I got on wine quite by accident. Doesn't that sound nice? Isn't that nice? But I got on it. Now, in those years, I had never heard the word alcoholic, but I had heard the word wino. Many times I had stumbled over these cats going from my hotel to the depot to go to work. And if I had any feeling for these people at all, it would be the fact that they didn't have the price of another drink. And I was so ashamed, even more so than being ashamed from the things I did with that word wino. God Almighty, it's terrible, particularly out on the West Coast. I don't think you have any winos here in, where the hell are we, Alabama? Georgia. And do you? It's predominantly a West Coast disease, you know. And people fuss at the poor old winos. They do, you know. They think they're kind of odd a little bit. But wine has some great medical proportions in it. The medical profession has been struggling trying to cure hay fever for centuries, and wine will cure it in a minute. If you drink it like I did, you don't dare sneeze. No, sir, you're certainly not going to sneeze. It'll cure it in a minute, dry you up in a hurry. If you don't believe that, you'll be born to the purple, I'll tell you. It's something. But what a great humiliation. What a great thing to feel as little and as small. And when I was running the last of the fine extra fare passenger trains, remember the old city of San Francisco?
was responsible for the lives of some 450 people every night on the fastest schedule on that particular railroad. And half of the time, didn't remember making the trip. That's not so bad. Wait till you wake up about 3 hours later and wonder what you did. And you can see trains coming at you from every direction. You can live the horrors of the damned. Those of you who have lived with these little flake-offs into limbo know what I'm talking about. Your calendar starts leaking. You wake up, what is today? I finally got so bad on the railroad that I had to go down around the 15th and the 1st of the month. And I had a friendly dispatcher down there, and he would tell me where I had been so I could turn in a timesheet. I didn't do that on purpose. When I was a young kid in school, I didn't set out to do that. When I took that first drink for fun, I didn't intend for that to happen to me. And I don't think that any of us set out to get caught in this trap. But by the time you feel the shackles of alcoholism and chains are too strong to break, when we discover it, the anklets are too strong to break. This is pathetic. It really is. And society, I suppose, will live with a barrier forever about the alcoholic. Because having not been there, they do not understand our motivation. And our loved ones in particular. Have you ever heard, if you love me, you would do that? And I think the alcoholic is ultimately capable of the deepest of love. God knows he can love when he's headed in the right direction. Oh, I ended up in the hospital. He ended up down. And they put me through one of the most stringent clinics on the West Coast in the big railroad hospital. From the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. And it's not a lot of fun with the shave. Did you ever go to a proctologist with a hangover? You don't sit there and recite the touch of the master's hand. Living torture, even that. And do you know what the result of this trip through the clinic was? Nothing organically wrong with me. How about that? Now, hospitals work on a peculiar theory. You've got to have something wrong with you. I suspect in some cases, even if they have to create it. But they have to do it, and they couldn't find anything organically wrong with me. And that was my introduction to psychiatry. And I would love to say that the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, of my acquaintance, who have had their alcoholism beaten out of them through their knees with a rubber mallet, are very few. Just ain't many of us come in that way. Now, I'm not too hard on psychiatrists. I've got one in the family. My wife's got a nephew that's got one. And he's a hell of a nice feller. Worthless as hell, but a nice feller. And he came to visit us not so long ago in his Jaguar. And he drove up in front of the house, and it was raining out. And he stopped to visit with the hedge and some of this stuff in the front yard. And I had to go get him in out of the rain. He was a frightful looking mess. He had gotten his coloring crayon all in his beard, and he had on a size 16 flea collar,
And my wife loves him to death. This is what I got in the hospital. They brought in one of them frustrated piano tuners, and he beat my knees with the rubber mallet and asked me some of the most personal questions. God damn, they can get personal with you, you know. One of them said to me, said, "Did you ever suck your thumb?" And I remember how pale he turned when I graphically told him I still do. And then then I told him about going off in the corner and taking a quick pull at it every now and then. And it's needless to say, he lost interest in my case. Now, I know that none of you folks ever going to need a psychiatrist because you're already to AA. But if accidentally you should ever need to get rid of one, I can tell you how. You let two drunks lay up in bed one night and memorize the same dream to tell him the next morning. Oh, they're all right. I'll give them an old suit every now and then. Okay. They threw me out of that hospital. Sent me back towards my home. I had come across another little dose that we've kind of phased out in our society. We used to have a lot of the girls in AA, and John will remember this, and if there's any other medical men, they started me on a little dose of sodium bromide elixir. They don't use it much anymore. It's a hell of a good ride. There's a beautiful thing about it. You can drink it and food doesn't disturb it. There's not much wrong with it. Your eyes will cross a little. And you may foam at the mouth some, but it's just a good dose. I love it. You know, it's really the granddaddy of nervine. You girls, you know, they used to say, you know, Aunt Minnie can't come out today. She's nervous. Aunt Minnie was stoned. And I get such a kick out of AA. That's what I like about Willie. She tells it like it is. Some of the girls that come to AA and tell their stories from behind the podium tell it a little nicer every time. And pretty soon you'd think that they did all of their drinking in one room and somebody squirted it through the keyhole with an eyedropper, you know. I'm waiting for some of them old broads that I used to drink with to get here, you know. Some of them very undainty old broads that used to slug it out with me in the bar, I'm waiting for some of them to get to AA. But they're now, they're nice. They tell it like it ain't. Well, I better start getting well now. They threw me out of the hospital. I forgot a story. I got to tell the story. It has no morals. As she told me about it, everybody wants to hear the story. It has really no moral value except to prove that the alcoholic can become completely oblivious to his surroundings. You know, the old drunk, he builds a shell around him. And our book tells us
that he cannot differentiate the true from the false. It says that in our book of experience. Years ago, I lived in a little town called Goose Creek, Texas, which is about 50 miles from Spring, Texas. And I was working for an insurance company, and my wife went off up into Illinois to help her sister have a baby, and while she was gone, I got tired, which was nothing new. In those days, I always, when I got fired from anywhere, I went home to Mama. It's just simple. Now, I don't know if you ever did that, but Mama had a fat purse and a nice place to sober up. And I always went home to Mama. So I loaded up. Incidentally, if you look on the map for Goose Creek, it's not there anymore. I don't know whether I had anything to do with it or not, but it's not on the map. They did away with Goose Creek after I left. But I loaded two cats that we had. We've always had cats, Mary and I, into this little car and headed for Tyler. And it was a cool winter night. And it was misting. Oh, a beautiful night. And the car was frosted up and the heater was going. And I got to the outskirts of Houston, over close to her house. And I saw a sign that read, 3 pints for the price of 2. And not being one to ever pass up a bargain, I bought the 3 pints for the price of 2. And I turned north to start towards Tyler, and I began to belch these pints. And God, it was a beautiful night. God was in his heaven, and everything was all right. And the car ran better. You never have done that, have you? And I'd sing, you know, oh, promise me, and talk to myself and win every argument. Just a beautiful situation. And I got up to a little town called Cleveland, Texas, and I got out to get a chaser for one of these jugs. And when I got back to the car, one of the damn cats got out. And I knew I dare not go home without this cat. And it was raining by this time, and just a sludgy mess, and I'm a little bit addled. And I staggered all over this little town and finally caught the cat up under a cotton gin and pulled him out by his hind leg, and I whipped him all the way back to the car. And I threw him in the back of this hot automobile, and he did a thing on that back seat that wasn't nice. It was a sort of a Picasso study in brown, really. And do you think it bothered me? I crawled right in, turned the heater up another notch, defrosted the windows, drove up the road singing, oh, promise me. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I threw up in the front seat. Started even. You know, I was like, yeah, it hurts me to even think of it now, you know. Didn't bother me a bit. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, it was just breaking day, and I was in a little town called Alpha, Texas, and they had 2 street lights in this long street. And I pulled over to one of the street lights to stop and take my breakfast. And there was a town clown there, a sheriff or something. He was a door rattler. And I guess it was his first chance to make an arrest in many days. And he came racing up to the car and beat on the glass. And he said, let that glass down. And he shot his head in that window and said, what do you think you're? Oh, my God. And he slowly walked away. when you put your arm around an old drunk. The book tells us that he don't know how he feels. It says in there, in the doctor's opinion, that he thinks that he's leading a perfectly normal life. He cannot differentiate the true from the false. So let's not try to make him come up to us. Let's get with him. And this last trip out of the hospital, I went home to Mama again after 20 years. Here's the smart guy from Beverly Hills in Hollywood, the resourceful guy that had all the answers, that had made a name for himself, who came home to die, had no other place to go. And my folks, my mother, was so impressed with my returning home that she had me locked up. Now, let's don't laugh anymore. Bill gives us permission to laugh in our book all we want to, because we've tried enough. He says in chapter 5 or 4, I believe, why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered. That's reason enough for we people who cried so long. And all hours of the night, why shouldn't we laugh? We've recovered. 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 And one morning came a fellow to my jail cell who I'd never seen before. And if I don't say anything else for you to remember tonight, remember this one word. He came unsolicited. Unsolicited. Now we have a chapter in our book, chapter 7, under title Working with Others. And the first lines of that book read like this, and I'll read it to you verbatim. Practical experience shows us that the surest immunity against drinking is extensive work with other alcoholics. This work, when all other activities fail, when your prayer group fails, when your sitting down and touching group fails, when your transcendental meditation group fails, this works when all other activities fail. And then the shot in the arm. The shortest sentence in our book of experience is followed by an exclamation mark. Carry this message to the alcoholic. That fellow that came to the jail that morning had read that chapter. Kind of came because he felt the same way that dear Bill did the night that he stood in the Akron Hotel, in the old Mayflower Hotel in Akron, Ohio, and said the words that put this society into motion. Suddenly, I realized that I needed him more than he needed me. We don't go to see drunks for atonement, for past misdeeds. We don't go to see drunks because they're alcoholics. We go to see drunks because we're alcoholics. And these people that misread our book and say, we work on a proximity of attraction rather than promotion. Read it again. That's our public relations proposition that says that we work on attraction rather than promotion. Our staying alive attitude reads in chapter 7, carry this message to the alcoholic. Doesn't qualify him. Doesn't say if he's ready. Doesn't say nothing. It's an unqualified sentence.
with an exclamation mark, one of the two exclamation marks in our book of experience, carry this message to the alcoholic. This feller needed to see me that morning to feed upon the sunken spirit of another alcoholic perpetuating sobriety. I didn't know that for a long time. And he stood in front of my jail cell and undressed me. And he told me all about himself. And I don't remember any of the profundities. I remember one thing, that he stood still. And I couldn't rattle him, and I couldn't cut him, and I couldn't make him react. And then I felt good in his presence. What are we playing with here? You can't sit this one out. Carry this message to the alcoholic. He told me all about myself through talking about himself. Never, oh hell, if he'd have talked about me, I could have answered all the questions. I could have justified my position. Talked about him. Did the thing that the book tells us to do. Carry the message. And I'm so grateful for that. You're looking at a dead man who wouldn't have been here if he hadn't come solicited. I'm not as grateful as I ought to be, but I work at it. When I stand in front of a group of people like this, I'm awestruck, absolutely awestruck. We who are condemned to die by a misunderstanding society to rise up and be here. How do you account for 1,300 people being here tonight? Why don't somebody account for that? How are you going to explain that away, what we're looking at here? And he took me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me many things, but the greatest thing that they told me was, "Hi, Joe. We're glad you're here." How long has it been since some of us drunks had ever heard a kind, receptive word that let us in the gate? How long? I don't know. Quickly, I'll tell you two little short stories. I don't know how long you worked with a drunk. Really, I don't. There's no limit. I worked with one for 4.5 years, and I thought he came in there, he was just like I was, a drunken slob. And I borrowed a drink of whiskey and poured it down him. I knocked him out, really, to get him to AA. I believe any way you get him there is good. And when he kind of came unshuckled from the drink, he was sitting in AA. And he stayed sober for 3 months and got drunk. Didn't hurt him a hell of a lot. He was used to it. But it blew hell out of my ego. And I said, "He's going to get sober under my direction." Then I went back and got him again. 3 months, drunk. Go get him again. 3 months, drunk. About like that. And I prayed about him. God knows I made a side job out of him. And I said, "God, you've been watching them sparrows too much to give me this one. You know, he's a hell of a thing." And he had a little thing wrong with him that none of you've ever done. He would go to faraway places and call me Celeste just to tell me he was drunk. 12 years ago, he got on for him what was his last drunk in one of our local motels, and he called another fella from our club who's not half as smart as I am, and he went out and talked to that bastard 10 minutes, and he stayed drunk until he died. And I hated his gut. I used to sit in the club, look at him and think, "You ought to be mine." And if I know anything of the treasures that God gives us in this society, I owe him more than he owed me. He kept me sober for 4.5 years. What the book say? Carries a message to the alcoholic. I can't tell you a great deal more about this society. I might tell you a little dialogue that I dreamed one night, and it could be you and me. We read in chapter 5 very frequently, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. What is our path? Well, our path is the 12th step. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. One night I got to thinking about the path, and I dreamed a little bit about it, and this could also be you or me. But I could see this guy walking down a path, very narrow. And in this path there were 12 gates, so situated in time and space that you couldn't reach over one to open the next. This fellow wanted the thing that was past that last gate called sobriety, and he set out industriously to go down the path. When he got to the first gate, it was terrifically hard to open. It showed signs of being battered and having been struggled with, and it would fly shut, but he finally got it open. And he admitted that this was the hardest gate he'd ever opened. He got to the second one and he thought, gosh, it'll be a little easier, I hope, and it was not. And he tugged with it and he opened it because he wanted what was beyond the last gate. And he finally got it open to his satisfaction. And he had to admit that that was a hard gate to open. He came to the third, and it showed the greatest of wear, but he was determined to find what was past the last gate. And he finally made it. And he made a decision that he'd never have to go through that one again. And then his spirit picked up, and with each gate, he became higher elated about the process of making these gates open. And each one, subsequent gate, was easier for him to open. And he thought, this is going to be a snap. I'll make this easy. Until he came to the last gate. And just as he approached it, he saw a fella laying across the path. And this was the dialogue. The fellow said, where are you going? Oh, I'm trying to pursue this path. How'd you get on that path? Oh, some fella came to the jail and told me about it and put me on it. Why don't you let me pass? I can't. I saw you coming and I tried to get out of your way. Would you help me get on the path? Oh, I would, maybe. It looks like I'm going to have to make some disposition of you if I'm going to pursue this thing and see what's beyond the last gate. Please help me get on the path. And he reached down and he picked him up. And to his amazement, he was neither offensive nor was he heavy. And it seemed that the strength was coming from both directions, that in the lifting he was being lifted. And he put him in his arms and started back down the path. Purely upon whim, he looked back at where the man had been lying, and that gate hung open. And in the joy and amazement, he discovered, like I hope you will, that this was the beginning and not the end. Thank you so very much.